Blog Talk Radio.
This is our official music by Alan James and a band called Newborn. And if you want to hear more of their music, you can go to newbornband.com. If you haven't heard about them, they are about to explode, and you are definitely going to hear them all over the place. So go ahead and check them out, newbornband.com. And now I'd like to welcome you to Books I Love on Tiffy Talk. This is where we talk to published authors and as well as unpublished authors and wannabe authors. We also speak to readers and publishers and all other things related to the written word. So if you do have a story to tell and you want to write it down in a book, or you just want to talk about it, this is where you can do it. This is where we want to hear your story. But if you've already written a book and you want to speak about it, that's what we are looking for. And so welcome. My name is Tippi Feldenstein, and this is where the written word will survive and thrive, because we have some amazing authors coming to us from all over the world. We had somebody from Switzerland 2 weeks ago. We had somebody from England maybe 3-4 weeks ago. And today we have someone really special coming to us all the way from Canada. Today's guest is J.D. Gussens. And he has written a charming book, which we will be talking about it. We will be talking all about it and let you know what it is. And that way, you guys might be just dying to check it out, because how could you not want to see a book, if you like to read, that you know is a great book and you know that you want to read about it? So let me welcome, and I'm very, very excited to welcome JD to our show today. Thank you so much for joining us, JD.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's totally my pleasure. I love authors. I have a special love for authors, because I know that most of the time it's something that cooks in your brain for a while, and then before it just goes into a pressure cooker, you got to find a way to get it out on paper. And is that what happened to you?
Well, it definitely was gnawing at me. It's the idea at first of having a book published was sounded very romantic and glamorous. So that was the initial drive of trying to get it out. But the actual reality of it is just that that day-to-day grind, and even on the other end of it is the promotional work that you do, and it's a lot of work. So I really respect my fellow authors as well in the work that they put in.
Yeah, you can definitely respect that when you walk in the shoes. So you wrote a really charming book called Tulane Roads, and I have to tell you, I know there's a story behind this title, so am I right?
I'm sorry?
There's a story behind the title. That's what I feel.
There is, yes, yeah. It's, well, at first, at first blow by when people hear two lane roads, they automatically go to the most common spelling and description: two lane roads, two roads on, you know, a two lane road, TWO. But it's actually spelled a little quirky. It's two lane roads, TOLAINROADS. So that is two lane roads, as in going to the roads that have been laid out for us. So kind of a marketer's nightmare, because people finding the book, it's in I've really had to spell it out literally for people, but I was very attached to that title, and I was working hard with the publisher, and actually the editor wanted to change the title, but it just stuck with her, and she said, well, no, we're not. Most of the time a title gets changed, an author's first working title would never be used, but it just kind of stuck with her. It takes on many meanings throughout the book, and it really fits the main character's sort of neurotic quirkiness, and so they kept it. But it does pose a few problems in marketing it as well. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of the fact that they kept it, but because it was a part of what I created. So
I can definitely see that. Definitely, yeah, I can definitely see that it's a marketing nightmare, but I can also see that it could be a marketing explosion, because when the title itself is already a big thing, then everything else is bigger. But to me, when I saw it, I didn't hear, if I would have heard two lane road, now that you said it, yeah, two lanes, a road that has two lanes, that makes sense. But when I saw it in print. I didn't hear it. It wasn't spoken to me. And I looked at it, and actually, there's more than two or three meanings that you can get out of it. It could be going to a road called lane also, to lane road, a road that's lane. I mean, it's like, you know how the Bible, every word you read sometimes has four or five different meanings? This title can be read into.
By the time it takes on several meanings as you read along, there is a character in the book named Lane Road. So that adds to the flip multi-personality of the title, and then it takes on one final sucker punch meaning at the very end.
Hey, you don't want to
leave it at that.
You're not going to tell anyone, right? Because we don't want to ruin the whole book.
So
the character, is that the hero or is it a sidekick?
Lane Rhodes is the you'd call him, without giving too much away, he's the roommate that the main character Nathan Mills. The gist of it is that he has lied to everyone he knows and everyone he's come in contact with about Lane, his experience with this Lane Rhodes in Vancouver, BC, and the events encircling their time spent together. So he, you could call him an antagonist, but he is sort of the alter main character to the book.
Hmm. And that's also another.
Whereas Nathan Mills is your protagonist in the book.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So that also takes on another side, Lane, lie, kind of lie about Lane. That's a different way. And so Vancouver, so you are born in St. Thomas in Canada, born and bred in Canada, moved to BC out of the university, and then you got a real job as a paint salesman, paint sales. That like sounds so glamorous. After 3 years, you quit and you went backpacking overseas to write a novel. That's pretty young to do that. How old were you by the time you did that?
Well, I worked 3 years at a school, so I was around 25 when I left. So
it's young. It's young. I mean, it's not college age, but it's smart enough maybe not to get in the kind of trouble you would have gotten if you left at 19.
I was a young 19 and a young 25, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot to learn still, so that's part of the reason why I got myself into this situation out in Vancouver, and so the book is actually loosely based on a real experience I had out there.
So it's loosely based on your experience as a backpacker, or your experience as life in Canada?
No, my experience rooming with someone in Vancouver and the major life-altering events that happened in that small span of time.
Yeah, I have to tell you, roommates have a way of really either destroying your life or creating a roommate. I have so many nightmare stories about roommates, so I can see how that would develop. So you quit your job.
This one will be with me for life. It'll be a part of me, because it sort of was a mirror into my own sort of psyche and my own sort of framework of value and values.
And life.
It really rocked it. It was still the biggest learning experience I've ever had in my life.
Wow, that's huge. Still the biggest one.
Yeah.
A good experience or not so good experience?
Well, everything.
Good,
I mean,
bad, ugly.
Looking back, I mean, looking back on anything, you can see the humor in the most sort of harrowing moments in hindsight, and these you got to look at these moments as things that needed to be for you to you know, move on. If it gives you perspective, then it's all worthwhile, I think. But
right, yeah. I mean, actually, I just read a quote yesterday.
If you're able to get on the other side of it, you know, intact.
Yeah, what doesn't make you crazy makes you stronger, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely.
And I mean that I discovered my passion for writing through it. So, I mean. All things
really?
How
did you discover your passion for writing?
Well, I in the aftermath of what actually happened back in BC, I would tell people parties or something. I was early mid 20s, so when I was in Vancouver, it was a very social time in my life. We were always at parties or going out to different events and that. And through the new people I'd meet, I tell this story. I told it a few times to begin with, and people's faces would just drop, and they mumble, "That sounds like a movie," or "Wow, I can't believe that. You cannot be serious." And I'd hear that over and over, and it got to the point where it was actually the story would find me. Like, I would go out to a party or an event, and someone would come up to me and said, "This is my friend Tom. You got to tell him your Lane story." Well, it wasn't Lane, but yeah.
Right.
You got to keep it fictional to protect everyone involved.
And yourself.
yeah. But it was over and over again. So the story just found me, and it came to a boiling point where I was at a party. And there was like easy 10, 12 people in a room, and they had all heard the story. And there was one person that hadn't, and they all looked at me and said, "Oh, Susie, she hasn't heard the story yet." And I said, "Well, okay, well, maybe I'll tell her sometime, I don't know, over coffee or something." They all said, no, tell her now. And it was a very long-winded, long, long story. I was like, "You are all going to sit through this just so she can hear it?" And they're like, yeah, do it. So that's when I just knew, like, I had a story, a gripping story, and it was I had the details, I had the framework for real story. It ended up being modified quite a bit, actually. But I just knew that people were relating to the story and reacting to it, and I got a rise out of that, and just the connection with people. I'm a real social person, so whenever I make a connection with someone, that's just everything for me. I really live for that.
Mm-hmm.
And
when is your birthday?
And I just pictured this book as that. What was that? Sorry.
When is your birthday?
When is it? It's August 22nd, 1976.
Hmm. Social time of year, definitely. So it's about the story or about the writing? Was it? So it sounds like it's more the passion of telling this specific story that had to come out. Obviously, it came out, whether you liked it or not. People made you say it. But
yeah.
What about the writing part of it? Because that's a very tedious, long time to do.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, when I sat down and just I set the goal for writing it, I had no idea what I was getting into. I was very naive. And the years went by as I was writing and writing and changing and writing about halfway through I was like, what did I get myself into? Like, I would never have started this had I known. But then it started to take shape, and like a good writing day is like a drug. It's you have a good writing day and you've managed to express yourself and to lay out a nagging thought in your head into and lay it out so that someone could really connect with it in one way or another it became addictive. I would get re-motivated daily. Like, sure, you hit your valleys where you're blocked and you know nothing to work in, or you read the worst thing is you read something that you thought was amazing and it really just falls flat kind of thing 3 days later because you've had sleep and you had some coffee or something. But for the most part, it was the process was all part of it. Part of the rush.
Well, how did you feel the first time you held the book in your hands with the title and your name and you're actually holding it? Can you describe that feeling? Because people really need to understand that.
Yeah, you know what? I had built that moment up in my head so much since I had found out I was going to be published and went through the editing. It was very intensive, the editing. So it all happened pretty fast. I found out in November of 2015 that I was going to be published, and they wanted to rush it out for a spring release. So we were hammering away on the phone for hours, working with an editor and working with the publishing house on getting it out. So that was all a big blur. Actually, I didn't really have a lot of time to try to soak in the moment because I was freaked out about making this kind of the best thing I could before it actually was permanent. And then the moment came where the book arrived, and I had imagined it was nothing like I had imagined. I thought, oh wow, it's going to come and it's going to be such a thrill to see it, and that existed. I mean, it was there, but it seemed to be muted by the pressure of now selling the book and getting my message out there so that people could read it and connect with it. That was my big dream, people reading it and maybe really kind of, I was a big reader, and whenever I had that connection with a book, those moments in a book where you just stop and you almost like close it on your lap and go, wow, reached out kind of thing. So that's what I really wanted. So it became more of a pressure thing. I was like, okay, I gotta get these books out. So I don't think I allowed myself much of the, oh wow, look at this kind of thing. And then those moments, like, they come to me at times where you know, like maybe I need to hang my hat on something. Like if I'm evaluating my life, it's like, oh, well, I got this done. I set my mind to it and got it done, and that's good. But it was different than I had imagined. Like the biggest thing was I always pictured it like climbing a mountain. Like it, you know, you're climbing a mountain, and there's breaks in the trees, and you see the view, and you see the top, and you see, you know, you stop to enjoy it, and all that stuff. And then you get to the top, and you know, plant your flag or whatever you do, you know, and take a picture. And you know, I always thought it like that at first, and then when the book came, and I finally, like, when it was published, it was almost like the first thing I thought of was like comparing it to an old dog that's been in the house for a long, long time, and you love it, but it's starting to smell, and you know, it's costing you a lot of money because you had to take work off to take it to the vet, or in my case, to write it. And I took a hiatus from work to do a bunch of writing and all that stuff. And then it finally sort of passes on and becomes that fridge magnet. It was like, that's kind of what it was in ways. It wasn't the romantic, like, oh, I did it. It was sort of like more of the release, like, and release.
Kind of reminds me about like
it's not very
like a virgin fantasizing about sex as if it's the most explosive thing in the universe, and then it's like, oh, that's all it is.
Yeah, I got that one out of the way, and now I can maybe enjoy it.
I guess you're right. It's about how you think it's going to be. And if you overthink it, if you think it's going to be this huge thing, then it ends up being, oh, I worked so hard on it, I don't even have time to really think anymore. But if you really don't even think about it, there might be a different way. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think it speaks to the process too. You gotta really like what you do, because that one grand moment is always going to fall flat if you don't enjoy the in between.
Exactly.
It's not.
So much. You just said so many things, and I have so many questions about it, because you said that you found out that you were going to be published last year, about a year before you actually got published. How did you find out? How did the publisher find you, and what happened? That's a huge story right there.
Yeah, that was interesting, actually. It came out of left field. I had chopped it around to agents and publishers.
You send out the manuscript?
Yeah, you just send out the manuscript with a query letter,
right.
Which is an art form in of itself, just trying to get the perfect sort of marketing letter out. And that takes a lot of learning, actually,
and a lot of time and a lot of patience.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of study. But it ended up not being my query letter at all that did it. So anyways, I had received rejection after rejection, like the typical writer does. They were mounting quite a bit. But many of them had these little side notes, like little compliments, maybe backhanded compliments because they were rejection letters, but little compliments, like little things like natural stylist or vivid characters or something like that, and then it would be no at the end. But
thank you
but
so
those
much,
little bits that they took the time to write in, and that I knew that it kind of let it be known that they were actually reading it, which was nice, because it did kind of, some of their comments really did fit with the manuscript, I thought. And so I received a bunch of those, and then 5 years had passed, and I was really sort of coming to the end of it. It was growing long, and it was becoming a stressful thing. So I was looking to self-publish, which is a lot of money, and zero support. So anyways, I was just about, I had stepped away from the book a little bit, and I was going to start to entertain that idea. And in that, I had sent the manuscript off to an editing service just while I was doing that, kind of on that break. I thought, okay, I'll get someone to really clean it up, do a real hard copy edit to it, which I had never really done. I had gotten some loose manuscript evaluations done through Writers Federations that were not really, they were skimming basically, because it was volunteers that were doing it. You don't pay a lot of money for it. It was like $50 and we'll look at your thing and they give you some high level kind of comments on it. But so I decided to hire this company. So I Googled, searched editors in Nova Scotia, and this company, Bullindry Island Press, came up. Didn't really click with me, but all I'd seen online was the editing service. So I, but I didn't want to pay the money without knowing.
Was it expensive?
I didn't know if my manuscript needed it.
Was it expensive? Was it a lot of money?
It was a good amount. It was a fair price, we'll say, but didn't have a lot of money at the time. I think it was like 600 Canadian, which is, I mean, probably not a lot to spend on your passion, but. Yeah.
Well, it's $600. You got to work for it somehow. Somebody's got to generate.
That's right.
Yeah.
So anyways, I bit the bullet and I sent it in there, and the manuscript came back with glowing remarks from the editor that was in charge of editing it. And you could tell she edited it with a real, like, not only a keen eye, but professionalism. And she was eager to mentor me in ways, like she just went above and beyond, and so did the owner of the company.
She loved it,
and
obviously.
and she edited it. Robin Marie Butt was her name. She did an amazing job, and the publisher, she ended up writing these reviews, and then she ended up pitching it to the publisher.
Wow.
She said, well, we should do something with this. And the publisher ended up reading the manuscript and agreed, and they ended up contacting me and deciding to go with it. It was a funny conversation because I didn't know they were even publishing. I didn't know they published books. So
yeah.
He started talking about moving forward, and we really want to do this by spring, and I was just thinking, what is he talking about? The editing has been done. I've paid my money.
What else do they want from me?
It was almost like I wouldn't allow myself to realize it. And then once it in, it was like, oh my goodness. So it really came out. It was funny.
Is,
it wasn't until I stepped away from it that it actually happened.
The light always shows up when you're just 2 seconds from giving up. I don't know why.
Yeah, that was a classic case of that for sure.
That's why perseverance, you know, always works. People, they just never give up. Eventually something happens.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds good. So how about, you have two sisters and a brother. Were they supportive while you were going through this whole process?
Most definitely, yeah. They've always been have a great support system with my family. I have an older sister who is the ultimate example of
support
of what to strive for. She blazed the trail for the rest of us, her siblings for sure. She's very successful and very humble. And very loving, and you know, she's someone you just, you know, she's someone
you
that you want to model, but at the same time, she's someone that you almost feel like you should despise, not despise, but like that's
like
harsh words, but someone you should be so jealous of and sick of, and it's like, but she doesn't allow that. She's just. She's never been about herself, you know, so so she just
so that's great to have
got
kind
this
of
attractive
model.
Force to her, and I've never felt like a failure in her presence, you know, even though she, on paper she's got quite a resume.
Wow, that's really always nice to have that in the family, to have, especially if it's an older sibling that you can follow, because younger siblings tend to really worship older ones anyway, but if they end up being more successful than an older one, it doesn't always work out so great. But when the older one is a role model, then it's like the proper order of things, the proper way that
for sure.
Yeah, so that's
it's
really
all
exciting.
I know, but
cool. Yeah, it's really, really cool. And it's really cool that you have a family that supports you, because these days you don't hear that too much. Usually families are very broken up, so that's really, really nice. So would you do it again now that you know what the process looks like? Do you want to do it again? Do you want to write another book? How do you feel about that?
Well, I've started writing a second book.
Oh, and, there you go.
at first I thought, like, I was wondering if it was a distraction, you know, if it was something that I needed, and it was a one-shot sort of deal, right? Mm-hmm. Something that I had lived, so vivid pictures are already in my mind of what happened. But I think I definitely bled more of a story out of what actually happened, that I feel confident in my in my writing skills, so that I could tackle another one. And I'm discovering that it wasn't so much a distraction as it is a passion. And it's really allowed me to connect with people. Emails are really the best thing in the wake of this book coming out. I'm getting emails from all over, and a lot of strangers really saying they connected with the story, and we're just sunken into the plot and the relatable characters and the humor and all that, and that's just been like one of those can sustain me for a couple weeks. It really, I'm walking on air when I get one of those emails. But
I want
that again, so I'm gonna. And I part of it is I want to prove to myself that I can do it again as well. Like,
I'm pretty sure you can. And it is addictive, like you said. You kind of remind me of Maria Murnane. She's a very big writer. She has written so many books, and she sells a minimum of 250,000 books every time she writes one. And that's exactly it. She wrote her first book just like you, a story, but now she's written like 17 books, all bestsellers. Some of them are series. You know, if you want to continue talking about Lane Rhodes, for example, his next stage or whatever. And that's exactly the word she used, that at first when she wrote it, she got, of course, everybody gets 1,000 rejection letters. But then once you get a taste of it, and, you know, you sit in your house and with your pajamas, and if you're a social person, it's a little bit more difficult because you want to be with people, but you also want to do this. And all of a sudden, the whole world is there reading it, and it's like a star is being burst open. I don't think you could stop writing even if you want to right now.
Yeah, it's something that I feel the need to do for sure. I find too that it's a steep learning curve. You really have to learn how to structure and create a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've done it once and gone through the editing process and learned all the nasty tics that you have, sort of that recur in your writing that you have to fix up, then I think the process is sped along from there on.
Yeah.
I'm noticing that I'm not making the same sort of first writer mistakes and time management as well. I mean,
For sure.
And one example is I spent easily 3 months writing this one section of the novel, just this one that I thought was, it was the funniest part, it was the best scene, it really spelled out the main character, it had a little bit of everything, and 8 days before the book, before the editing process was done, they had chopped the entire scene.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's the process.
But without even the book being seen by an editor, I'd spent all this time just polishing this scene, and it's not the way to go. You want to really get the guts of it down, I think, before you start really cleaning it up.
So you're saying you want to get the entire draft, first draft, out on paper before you start redoing and re-editing it? Is that the best way?
Well, I think everyone works differently, but I think for a time management thing, I definitely wouldn't spend as much time worrying about a single phrase or a single passage or a single scene.
Because at the end, you may have changed anyway. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, in the end, it could be cut out anyways. It might be a good scene, but it's a wrong book kind of thing. You know, if it doesn't further the plot, or if it affects the story arc, then it doesn't belong, no matter how well it's written or how well you think it's written.
Yeah, so I think time management is a really good tip. And so what advice would you give to somebody or to people who want to write a book and they have a great story? What would be the number one tip that you learned the hard way that you would want to pass on?
Focus on your vision for the story and do not write in every single anecdote or funny joke or moving memory in your bank, because it might not fit in the plot. So what I had done, I had written my first draft, and it was 2.5 times the length of my novel that my novel is right now.
Wow.
And it was epic. It was the length of an epic, but it was it was humor fiction, which there's very few, I think, humor fiction novels that are that thick and heavy. So, but what I had done was I had just tried to work in every single funny or entertaining thing that ever happened in my life, I think, regardless of how it affected how big the tangent was that it took, or how much it affected them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I put in, I mean, you do have to do that. You have to put in what you do have to do that in a way. I mean, you have to put down things and things will get cut, but at the same regard, you'll save a lot of time focusing on driving that story forward and moving to the climax kind of thing. So
don't try to include everything on the planet in your manuscript. It's okay to
exactly.
Leave something out. That's really important, because once you write it, it's really hard to let it go.
Just want to focus on what you're trying to accomplish rather than
focus on what you're trying to accomplish. I think that's really the best advice you can give anyone, because if you don't focus on what you're trying to accomplish, you're just trying to lay it all there. That's not appropriate.
It's sort of square peg. You don't try to make something. Don't force it.
Right.
Don't
right.
force it in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. So right now,
another quick one is just set a regimen, like a regular routine. At the same time every day, you sit
for
in front of your computer for writing. Yeah. every day you sit in front of your computer at the same time and you give yourself, it can be as little as 10 minutes, but you have to sit in front of the computer for 10 minutes, even if nothing comes, even if your mind just wanders and maybe one thought ends up, or a fragment of a thought ends up being something that you can use. You at least dedicate it, the time to it. But it's got to be regular.
7 days a week?
It's got to be every day, yeah.
What about if it's 6 days a week? I'm asking you because this is really important. This is a very important tip, I think, that people don't realize that if you sit for 10 minutes a day and you dedicate it to the book, even if you don't write anything, those 10 minutes mean so much than not doing anything and not sitting in front of the computer, not even thinking about the book. Because basically what you're saying is take a few minutes, 15 minutes, half an hour, 10 minutes per day to think about the book, no matter what comes out.
Yeah, that's a win. I mean, you should feel good about doing it. I mean, if you sit down in front of the computer and not one word comes out, you should still feel good about the fact that you are there.
Right, you sat down. Because you sat down and thought about it. That's the win.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so, but what you hear a lot from people is, I've started writing a book and all of a sudden 10 years passed by and I didn't get anywhere. And if you focus every day, if you give 10 minutes a day, which is nothing, what's 10 minutes a day, then 10 years are not going to pass by without you thinking about it. One day is not going to pass by without you thinking about it. Even if you do nothing, you're still sitting there thinking about it.
It kickstarts your day, whereas maybe later on in the day you'll still get in the zone of running that story behind your head, because that's how it works. You have to think about it constantly while you're doing your day-to-day.
That's really, really powerful. And the story sounds really, really fun and amazing. And I definitely want to read word for word the whole book now, because you really made me want to do it. And I want to find out who this Lane Rhodes is and why the name Two Lane Rhodes. So as much as it could be a marketing nightmare, I think it could be a marketing gift too. And I really would, I think everybody that's listening to this is going to want to read the book. There's no question about that. But as far as you're concerned, are you doing anything else now rather than writing? Do you have a different job too, or are you dedicating full time for this?
No, it does not even come close to paying enough to do it full time. But I've always waitered during the mm-hmm. writing of it.
Mm-hmm.
I needed a job. After I'd gotten back from traveling, trying to get my notes down for the book and that, I needed a job that kind of coincided with my with the book and the writing. And I found I was most productive in the morning, and that could flow into the afternoon. So I just fluked to this waitering job in Toronto. I was living in Toronto at the time, and. Mm-hmm. I waited at this wine bar called Jamie Kennedy Wine Bar. And it was it was the most dynamic place I've ever been in my life for employment. It was a wine bar. Jamie Kennedy was a chef in Toronto, very well-known Canadian chef. And he was pioneering a slow food movement in the city and around. And everything came farm to table, fresh, nothing shipped for miles or anything like that. He was sort of the first guy to start really driving home that saving the environment and saving everything and improving the quality of your food and supporting local mm-hmm. economy. And so this kitchen was all they just used whatever was fresh at the time. So the menu would change every lunch, every dinner, every meal.
Wow.
You'd have a new menu with fresh items. And serving there was like a career. You had to
learn about
food. Yeah, you had a 20-minute menu meeting before every shift. And then the wine program was just as dynamic, where wines would change day to day on the wine list. So servers had to be trained in wine. They did wine classes 2 hours every week, and then paid for wine courses free to take outside of work. And then And so it was just, and I ended up serving with these people that were so talented. These fellow servers were all studying to be naturopathic doctors, sommeliers, and fashion designers, and they've all really made it quite big out of this one little pocket of servers in Toronto. And it was inspiring. They all inspired me to be better, and it drove home the idea of, I really need to get this book out, because these people are doing something with themselves. And some of the best times of my life working with these people, and it really inspired me to get the book done. And that, so serving has always been, that sort of sparked it with me, with serving, and serving also allows me that social interaction with not only with coworkers, but with customers alike.
Right.
So it really feeds that sort of need to connect with people. So
yeah, especially if you're a social kind of person. But did you also become a wine lover and become like a wine expert?
I was on my way. I came to a crossroads, actually. I was gonna scale back the book and actually try to further my wine knowledge and maybe try to do that as a career. And right at that, I was gonna train for my sommelier a ticket, I guess, so to speak. But I ended up choosing the book and just saying the book is number one.
And I'm glad you did. Yeah.
I still enjoy wine and discussing it and drinking it. But it's definitely taken a backseat to what I'm doing.
Yeah, maybe one day you'll have a story about wine that you might want to talk about.
I could use some of that stuff.
Well, I can't believe time really flies, but there is one more thing that I have to ask you before I let you go, and mm-hmm. that is your backpacking experience. Not everybody drops everything and goes backpacking. I know some people do, and everybody has a different kind of experience with backpacking. Was that also a life-changing experience, like the roommate thing, or was it something that you kind of got out of the way?
No, it was experience. I went alone, so that I
dangerous.
Could really work on the book and have my time when I needed my time.
Mm-hmm.
So the biggest thing I took from it, I mean, it was a lot of fun visiting different places. And my sister was actually living in Australia at the time, and I managed four months with her, and that was a special time for us. But the biggest thing was how to be alone. And learning how to be alone and be comfortable with being alone. Because I think that's a real skill that is undervalued in society.
Yes, I totally agree. Yeah, I totally can relate to that. Because for me, that was really hard. Being a social person. And being always surrounded with a lot of people. I also have 8 brothers and sisters. And being alone was such a huge transition, but it's such a beautiful thing, too.
Well, that's where you do your most work. And not necessarily work, like working on yourself.
Well,
you know what I mean. But,
trying to work on yourself, at least.
I don't want to turn this into that kind of show, but I just find today that it's almost like a taboo. It's something that's looked upon negatively. It's like if you stayed home alone for the night, it's like, oh, I need to be doing something, or I need a friend around. I think that's why people are driving towards the social media so hard, because they don't know how to just be with themselves. And you don't have to take a picture of yourself alone at a at the grocery store or
selfies. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Public toilet selfies or whatever you do, you know. I saw one of those the other day. It was clean. It wasn't anything, but someone thought it would be funny.
Mm-hmm.
To take a picture of them sitting at the sink, washing their hands. But
I don't know.
People
have taken the most bizarre pictures I have ever seen. So being mature, I think, is being alone. Learning how to be alone is part of maturing and building a character. It could be really hard for people that are social people. But I think also it goes the other way. People that grew up alone, like an only child that was always alone with that kind of growing up, might want to do the opposite, be with people and go out and travel to be with a lot of people. So it depends. For you, obviously, you're a social person, so being alone was a learning experience. And I could definitely
relate. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So,
from a decent sized family. But,
the character
in the book, Nathan Mills, feels very alone at one point, and it's not a good alone.
Right.
But,
so, that, like anything else, it's not that in itself, it's what you do with it, and it's how you feel about it with anything. You can take the best experience in the world, like marriage, it can be the worst nightmare, it could be your best thing. Like anything else, and like writing. But I think you really definitely have a positive experience, and that usually means that you have a great book, because when you have a negative experience, you can't possibly have a great book. It doesn't make sense. So
well, looking back on it, I managed to write a humorous novel on a topic that might not have been so humorous at the time. So it's definitely lessons learned and able to look upon it fondly.
Yes, I don't remember who it was that said, if you can't see the humor in your problems or in your headaches, then you'll never see the humor in anything. The humorous things in life are the most painful things. Like if somebody has something about themselves that they hate, like let's say somebody has a big nose and he sees it as humorous as opposed to, oh my God, I'm so ugly. Life is completely different that way.
Mm-hmm. Takes the pressure off, for sure.
And it makes it humorous, and you can write a novel about it, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so where can we find the book if we want to get a copy?
It is available for U.S. customers. It's available on Amazon.com as an e-book, and Amazon.ca as a physical copy if anyone wanted to get go the traditional route. And that's where it stands right now. Most of the other distribution channels run through Canada alone.
Mm-hmm. So we have to go all the way to Canada to pick up? No, I'm not kidding. You just said
you can order it through Amazon, and it'll get it there. But as far as brick and mortar in the U.S., it's not quite there yet. I'm hoping maybe in the future. But
I wouldn't mind going to Canada.
It's spread out across Canada for sure. But.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think it's great the way that we came together, that you actually ended up on our show. Is my producer was visiting Canada, and he saw you, and that's usually not how we bring people on the show. We don't run around all over the world saying, "Hey, you." We had people
just hope to run into your guests.
Yeah, I mean, it was really like meant to be.
Yeah, it was a great moment. We actually had a good connection, and we were chatting, and he got you on the phone immediately. Before I knew it, I was talking to you and planning this interview, and it was great.
Like a natural progression, just like the way you found your publisher. It wasn't at the point where you're like, okay, fine, I'm going to go the route and do it myself. Boom, you get a publisher. Which is amazing.
It goes to show too. You gotta be ready. Not be ready, but you just gotta give people their fair shot. Because you never know. You never know what they're made of. I found that in serving. A lot of servers are treated like crap and considered. Unintelligent or considered unmotivated, or just from the start, it's just that they're prejudged right off the start, and you never know what's going on behind them. Because if you had done that with a lot of the people that I've worked with, path, you'd be shocked and in awe of what they've accomplished and what they can accomplish. So,
I have to tell you that's very close to home, because my daughter started out as a service. She quit. She didn't want to go to college. She said, I don't want to go to college. That's it. And I'm going to be a waitress. I was like, oh God, she's going to be a waitress for the rest of her life. Well, she actually ended up working for huge chefs, very well known. She fell in love with the wine and she became a wine expert. And now she's managing an entire company. But, you know, being a server or being somebody that washes dishes or whatever it is that somebody does to survive is not a shame. It's actually honorable. They're not stealing money. They're not lying. They're not conning people out of it. It's hard work, and it's really not easy to do, to deal with people, especially when it comes to food. You're dealing with a lot of crappy people, especially when a person is hungry. That's the worst. Even if you have a great personality, when you're hungry, your personality is not so great. So
a good server is also a career. I've met a lot of people that is their career, and they're great at it, and it's hard work, and they do really well.
Right. So yeah, that's definitely an important lesson. So I can't wait for you to have your next book out. I definitely think it's going to be just as great. It's going to be just as good. We're going to be focusing with you on bringing your book to the United States, into Barnes & Noble and all the big chains. Although I think Barnes & Noble is kind of closing up shop, but there's a lot of other bookstores. And Amazon really is the biggest place where anybody buys books from anywhere in the world. It's not.
Yeah.
Anymore those little stores that you have to get your book into. It's more like, who doesn't go to Amazon first to look at anything?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't exist. So I think that's
I'm the only way I can get to the U.S. market, which I'm thankful for. But I was working. The way I met your producer was down at the Seaport Market. I had set up a table marketing the book to cruise ships, passengers, and yours.
Uh-huh.
Your producer was on one of the cruise ships, and we had gotten to talking. But I've had great feedback from the U.S., which has been thrilling for me. I get really, really great emails pouring in from people from the U.S. and comparing the book to some heavy hitters there, which really, really is touching. I recently received one from a gentleman that he compared the book to Confederacy of Dunces, which is a.
Do you have his review? Do you have it? You have it written in front of you?
It's on my computer. I don't have it spelled out, but
he went on
to say it was he felt like it was on par, and he was. He was invested in it as much as that one, and I read that one, and it was a heady compliment. I think he was a tad generous, because this one had won a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh wow!
But just the fact that he did with it as just like he did the other one was enough for me. But he said it's similar comedic effect to that book, which I think is an absolute masterpiece. So just for him to even lay it out like that was nice.
sounds amazing. And with the last 45 seconds that we have, give us your website.
It's BoulindryIslandPress.com, BoulindryIslandPress.com, and then you can find my page on there. Just look for JD Cousins on the under the authors. Lineup.
Well, JD, why don't you send me the link? I think I already have the link, and I will put it right here below at the introduction so you guys can just listen to us talking and click on the link at the same time. I will put it right below right here for you. And we want to wish you lots of luck and thank you so much for joining us. We really are lucky to have you. And I think you have a lot of things inside of you that are about ready to come out. And we're looking forward to definitely listening to that and hearing everything that you have to say. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure, the process and the interview in the end. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. And now we've come to the end of our time together here on Books I Love and Sippy Talk. My name is Sippy Feldenstein. I've been talking to J.D. Goodens. And wait a minute, I said the name wrong. It's J.D. Goossens. And we have really, really enjoyed having you here. Once again, have a wonderful evening. Thank you for joining us. We bid you a magical journey and let your talent be your potion.
Thanks so much.
Been running through me like you got somewhere to be. You're stuck in a full-time daydream. Always in a rush, I know you're busy. Girl, you don't need a man, you got a phone in your